Welcome back to Money in America with Randall Turner. Today, my special guest is Timothy Sandifer. He's an attorney, and he's the author of the book, The Right to Earn a Living. Welcome aboard this morning. How are you, Timothy?
I'm just fine. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell me, what is the crux of your book? What is the thesis?
My book is about the right of economic choice, the right to make decisions for yourself about your economic affairs. That is, your right to earn a living by opening your own business or working for somebody else, your right to buy and sell property, your right to go into a trade to provide for yourself and your family without unreasonable interference by the government. And this was long considered one of the fundamental rights of all American citizens. In fact, it was considered one of the fundamental rights of all British subjects before the Revolution. As far back as Shakespeare's time, you'll find courts saying that this is one of the essential rights of all people. And yet, unfortunately, in recent decades, we've seen government turn its back on this right and burden people's freedom of economic choice in increasing ways.
Okay, now, I've read your book, but my listeners probably haven't. Tell me why, I guess a better term would be, how did that happen? You write it pretty much in the 1930s, so that really started to change.
That's right. It was the 1930s was the culmination of a movement that we now call the Progressive Movement. And during that era, the progressives increasingly thought of the right of economic choice as really just a privilege that government allows you to engage in trade or allows you the freedom to open a business and things. But if the government decides that it wants to, it can restrict that freedom, and increasingly came to do so. And then it was in the 1930s that the Supreme Court issued a series of decisions that said that when the government wants to intrude on your freedom of economic choice, that it can do so virtually without limit.
Why? I don't understand.
That was a product of the New Deal era, because what happened was that the federal government began implementing a broad national regulations over the economy, and these were challenged constitutionally in the Supreme Court. And there was a long line of cases that said that the government could not violate people's freedom of choice in this way. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court changed, partly under political pressure and partly because of philosophical trend.
Well, why didn't the Congress, force new laws to reverse the trend?
Well, because the Congress was dominated by New Dealers at that time. The New Deal the Great Depression was seen wrongly as a great collapse of the free market system and as proof that people cannot be trusted to make their own economic decisions, and that therefore the government has to oversee those decisions in order to make the market fair. And what happened, Franklin Roosevelt adopted a wide variety of giant federal programs. The most notorious is the National Recovery Act. And now I detail all of this in an article I published in National Review in September. The National Recovery Act, what it did was it adopted a series of nationwide cartels that allowed industries to draw up rules saying how much they would produce, how much they would charge, and how many people they would hire, and no business was allowed to deviate from these rules. Well, we call that a cartel or a monopoly nowadays. But this was allowed under the National Recovery Act, and so what happened, of course, was established and politically well-connected businesses could use this to stifle competition and throw entrepreneurs in jail for simply charging lower prices. And unfortunately, this was defended in front of the Supreme Court, and eventually the Supreme Court upheld it. Now, at first, the Supreme Court tried to resist, and there was the famous incident in which Franklin Roosevelt threatened to pack the court with his own Supreme Court justices, right, a new majority of Supreme Court justices that would be loyal to him. That didn't go through, but the Supreme Court backed down after he threatened that and began upholding the New Deal decisions. And what happened was they developed then a body of precedent that said that if the government wants to violate your freedom to run a business or earn a living without unreasonable interference, that basically the courts would refuse to enforce that right.
Well, in your book, you talk about various professions who have to go through this kind of licensing hoo-ha.
Yeah.
Can you recite the story about the Miami taxi cab?
Oh, yeah. So this is a case that I was researching about 10 years ago that in Miami, at that time, it cost about $15,000 or $20,000 to get government permission to operate a single taxi cab. Now, that, what you do is you have to get a medallion, they call it, in order to run a taxi cab in Miami. Now, of course, no taxi driver can afford that kind of money. Because taxi drivers are not exactly, you know, rich white guys from nice neighborhoods. And so what ends up happening is that all of the medallions are owned by a handful of big companies, and the drivers then lease these licenses, and that means that they have to work from Sunday until Thursday to pay for their licenses, and then they keep the rest of the week's earnings. The situation is far worse in New York City, where in New York to operate a taxi cab costs about $500,000. Now, 100 years ago, you could have taken your Model T, and you could have painted on the side of it, taxi, and started earning an honest living by driving people around the neighborhood and charging for it. But nowadays, entrepreneurs don't have that opportunity. Instead, they're barred from the market. And the only reason why is to protect established taxi cabs against fair competition from entrepreneurs. Okay. It doesn't protect the general public to restrict the supply of taxi cabs. If there were too many taxi cabs, the public wouldn't buy from them, and they would go out of business. So right. The idea that this is somehow balancing the market and making sure it's fair is nonsense. What it is it's a barrier to entry that is designed and implemented to support the taxi cabs that have political influence. And unfortunately, this scheme operates in just about every city in America.
Well, okay, well, I'm a math guy, so I'm still trying to work on the math. That medallion, is that a lifetime thing, or is that just for 1 year?
It differs based on the city, but it's often a lifetime thing where, and some cities have adopted rules where the driver can own the medallion and leave it to his family in his will. Wow. And it's considered a property right. But it depends on the city.
Well, I was just blown away with your $600,000. I mean, I kept trying to do math. How much does a taxi guy make in a year? I mean, $100,000 would be a big year.
I don't know that, but I do know that just a few years ago, there was a retired taxi cab driver in New York City named Ray Kottner. He bought an old, used, beaten-up taxi, and he started, just for fun, driving people around Manhattan and not charging them. And he would just take tips.
Right.
And he reported that he actually earned more money that way than he did when he was a taxi driver. But, of course, the established taxi industry in New York City didn't like the idea that this guy was out there competing with them and not charging their cartel rate. And so they had him fined, and they had his taxi cab impounded.
Well, just this past week, the Senate voted on S-510, I believe is what it is, the Food and Drug Enforcement Act. And in that, I understand that if you're less than, well, anybody would now submit to government rules on selling vegetables down at the corner farm market in the summertime.
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds like we've gone from municipality to a federal kind of thing. The way I understand is that Monsanto is the biggest one behind all that because they want to control the seeds and whatnot, and that you will not even be allowed to grow stuff without having approved seeds.
I'm not at all surprised about that. That's basically what happened in the 1930s with the Agricultural Adjustment Act and other federal legislation. There's a rule in California, which grows about a third of the entire world's raisin crop. The federal government confiscates as much as half of the entire raisin crop of California under federal laws that are designed explicitly. I mean, Congress is quite open about this. These federal laws are designed solely to raise the price of raisins. What they do is they force raisin growers to hand over a fraction of their crop, that differs per year. It's been as much as 50%.
Why?
And they're required to hand over these raisins, and the federal government then sells these raisins under its own brand name and then gives the proceeds of the sales to the raisin growers. And the raisin growers challenged this and said this is an unconstitutional taking of their property. The federal courts said, oh, no, this is a toll that you pay for the privilege of doing interstate business, which is ridiculous because we all know that under the current interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, you can't even sell raisins on a sidewalk without being subject to these federal laws. And yet that's the way the courts see it nowadays, is that it's a privilege for you to sell the raisins you grow, and that the government can then tax you for that privilege by making you give up your crop.
Okay, the way I understand the law is when a judge rules on a certain case, he has to look at precedent, what happened before, and then he has to rule according to that precedent, right?
No.
Okay.
It's supposed to be that way. But what happened was, because of the Progressive Revolution that climaxed in the 1930s, courts started saying, well, the Constitution is a living document. The law must bend and change to meet the changing needs of the day. And in 1934, in a case called Blaisdell, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, to argue that the Constitution means today what it meant when it was written is just silly. And they never actually provided any reason why that was silly, but they just said it was silly. So therefore, they were going to consult modern-day circumstances and change the law, basically, to meet what politicians thought was a good idea. And that's what we've got today.
Okay, you've told us all the bad parts about these different things. What's the hope I have for the future to change these things and go back to a truly free market capitalistic society?
I think we have good reason to be very optimistic, actually. I think people are showing a great deal of more interest and passion about the ideas of limited government, constitutional rights, and free markets nowadays. One example of that is the Tea Party. Now, there's a lot about the Tea Party that is that's not good. But at heart, what that movement is about is people reasserting their constitutional rights and the ideas of freedom of choice in the economic sphere as well as in other spheres, and saying that the government shouldn't interfere with those rights. And what we've seen also is in the recent decades, seen some courts starting to pay more attention to the right of economic liberty. There have been several challenges in the courts to licensing laws and other restrictions on freedom of trade. I'm doing a case right now, actually, in Missouri. If you want to run a moving business in Missouri, you first have to get permission from all of the existing moving businesses. And we're challenging this law under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And similar cases have been brought across the country and have been victorious. I won a case a couple of years ago in California in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, challenging a restrictive licensing law. And the court said, government cannot use these laws simply to give a favor or a preference to a preferred economic group. So I think there's good reason to see the tide turning, but it's going to be a long process, and it's going to require a lot of education and argument and thoughtfulness on the part of those who assert individual rights.
But is not the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals the supposedly the most liberal court in the country?
Indeed it is. So it was a gratifying thing to see them rule in favor of free markets that one time.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Timothy Sandifer, the author, attorney, and author of the book The Right to Earn a Living. And I would wholeheartedly recommend his book to you. And this has been Money in America.